to divert attention from real public health issues since the beginning, at a time when many people didn't feel like it was a politically expedient thing to say such things, especially here in the APHA. I'm just going to say a few things. I don't think I'm going to give many revelations. There'll be one that will be new, I think, to most of you. And I think you'll know it when you see it. But except for that, not too much is new, but they also may be some things that haven't been on your attention. So I really don't have any relationships to disclose. You've heard where I work. I'm a primary care doctor. I work in the South Bronx, and that's I'm also global health advisor for Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and then, as you've heard, I work with Doctors for Global Health and the People's Health Movement and some other groups as well. So I just want to talk a little bit about what I call lions at the door, and you'll see why, I hope, as we finish up. So there's an anthrax case in point. Remember, those happened on the 18th September and again 9 October. They happened a week after 9/11, 2001. I always say 2001 because I want people to remember that 9/11 throughout Latin American history should make you think about Pinochet and what happened in Santiago, Chile. 10,000 people rounded up and purposefully murdered after torturing them with the direct help of Henry Kissinger. And then we have scientific integrity and under big bioterror funding. I don't know where we all are in this room in terms of where we get our funding. I guess I know where one of you is, and I appreciate you being in uniform here. You've got a great sense of humor. I've seen you laughing at some of this stuff, too. Everybody's welcome in thinking about bioterrorism and thinking about how the funding here should be certainly examined closely. And then civil liberties under biofear mongering. I live in the Bronx as well, and so I thought I'd do a little bit of a participatory investigation as to ways to approach the bioterror problem, and this was what I found. It's a local store. There's these chinches, which are these little bugs, bed bugs they're called. And there are a lot of things in here that if you eat them and swallow them, will cause you a whole heap of terror. So that Capitol Hill anthrax matches Army stocks. You know, I mean, it's pretty clear to most people that the spores of anthrax that came and killed those five people and messed up a whole lot of other people in myriad ways, both the people who were sick and the people who whose careers were ruined and lives were ruined. These were actually from an Army lab. There are five laboratories that they could have been from. We're pretty sure we know which one. And that was very embarrassing. And in the same way, you know, they looked at Science Magazine, published an article looking at that. And so I would call it a prima facie evidence. No matter egg on the face, no matter who among the hundreds of candidates of persons of interest, because what the FBI would do is declare somebody a person of interest who had worked in one of these labs, all the attention would be focused on that person. But no matter which one of them did it, amerithrax, as some people have called it, came from a U.S. government bioterror lab, demonstrating a danger, not the only one, of developing lab experiments with bioterror. Now, one by one, there were lives ruined in this terror mongering. An Egyptian scientist, I won't even name his name, he doesn't need that extra publicity. I guess Egypt doesn't either, but we can't help that. Working in a U.S. government lab, was initially accused, exonerated. There's a guy named Hatfill. I don't know, if you go back and look at his whole history, he was in Rhodesia. Anyway, there's a lot of things going on. So all I can tell you is that he, after suffering a lot, came out okay with like $2 million settlement with Ashcroft and the government to clear his name. And then In mid-2008, the FBI sent investigation on Bruce Ivins. Now, you don't have to vote, but I'm just wondering here, how many people here think that Ivins did it? Well, either people are scared to vote or, okay, there's just only one up here, or nobody. They actually did an online survey and they found, for what good that is, epidemiologically, they found like 3% of 200 people thought so. Very interesting. He died on the 1st of August of an overdose of, I usually use generic medications, but in this case, I think it's okay to say it was Tylenol number 3 that did it. And, you know, federal officials officially announced that he was the one a few days later when it was easily possible to do so. You know, I mean, it's just kind of weird to me that that sequence would be that quick. But anyway, whatever you want to think about it, it needs to be more deeply investigated than this, I think. So we got a letter from Hillel here. Said, according to unnamed sources, the 2000 case of anthrax, we're told that the government microbiologist was the one and only one guilty. It'll be closed. We don't know, but you shouldn't just say that because the man committed suicide that he's guilty. That's a past belief. In fact, it was only after the suicide the government announced they were planning to indict him. All right. It's a shame that he's not around to look more deeply into it, a shame for him and for his family, and also a shame for us, and the families of the people that were directly affected. So where there's fear factor smoke, there's a fiery question. One goal of the Amerithrax investigations, the investigations themselves, seems to have been a fear focus maintenance on serial terror threat individual suspects. And off the question, how was it possible to access the U.S. government-sponsored labs? And is it wise to even have these labs if such made-in-the-USA elements are so easy to set free in the local mail-in murder? This is the surprise. Even I was surprised. You may remember that, I talked to this guy and he had such a flat affect that I just thought he deserved to have a different. Anyway, so look closely. So anyway, I won't call him this one. I will say that John McCain was on the David Letterman show a few days after the letters were mailed. Does anybody remember what he said? He said they probably came from Iraq. That's what he said. And on David Letterman, well, you know. Anyway, now I've heard it rumored that he said that this one really said it. Okay. The bio war defense. And so now I want to talk a little bit about money, big money. I don't know if any of y'all depend on that money or get it. I don't blame you if you do, but I just want you to think, you know, when you got this big of money, it's going to change what people study, what they apply for in terms of funding, what they can just to stay alive. And I don't want to pick on North Carolina necessarily. There's 8 different labs like this around. I'm from Georgia originally, and I went to school in North Carolina, so I don't feel that bad, really. But so here's there's a great website, and I put it up there, and I'd like for you to just, if you want to know more about this, it's really extensively documented and beautifully written. It's Robin Kurtz, Curtis, and it's Risk and Cost of Biodefense. And some of the premises are, and I took out the ones that have been addressed by other people here, that defense research threatens to undermine the Biological Weapons Convention. It poses a threat on public health and safety of citizens, especially when it's near populous places. And new laws under the umbrella of biodefense threaten civil liberties and reward giant pharmaceutical biotech companies with huge money grants and grant immunity from lawsuits for dangerous drugs and vaccines. So, looking here, for example, right after 9/11, 2001, Bush requested and was granted billions of dollars, and so people just couldn't resist, right? And North Carolina universities jumped on it. And so you had a $3.5 million $1,000 a contract for this person, Jeffrey Freelinger, at UNC Chapel Hill, and he's to study tularemia. Now, I don't know if y'all have ever, has anybody here gone rabbit hunting? No, you don't have to say. I mean, I have. I'm from down south. You get tularemia from killing a rabbit and with ungloved hands, basically gutting it and getting the tularemia. There's about 200 cases a year in the United States. It's not person to person. Really, in order to study to see it, you would have to make it into a weapon in order to study that weapon. And that's the case of a lot of these things. So what Duke University, and this is actually from the Duke University Bulletin. So Duke University is very proud of this. They're part of a new biodefensive initiative, a consortium of educators from six universities. They're going to work at the Southeast Regional Center for Excellence for Emerging Infections and Biodefense, CERCEB. And you can see it's from a lot of folks there in the South. They got $45 million to begin with. It's going to do a core facility. They built something. I'll tell you the name in a minute. And its initial work is with smallpox, monkeypox, anthrax, and pestis, just what we need, right, in our research triangle there, to be having these organisms available. The government partners with the CERCEB teams, you can see a few of them here, Yerkes, NIH, Oak Ridge. I thought they did nuclear stuff, never mind. And then it's a newly built Duke Biocontainment Lab. And the lab is called the Global Health Research Bill. Everybody had to jump on the bandwagon of global health. So there it is, global health, but they have a little twisted meaning to it, hopefully different than many of us mean when we talk about global health. It's currently categorized as a BSL-3. Now, you may not know that a BSL-3 lab can be, they call it upgraded, to a BSL-4 lab without telling anybody in the area. And the 4 lab is working with much more dangerous entities. Okay, and then that doesn't happen everywhere without some people getting upset, and we certainly wouldn't want it to happen at home. So in Boston, 150 scientists said, nuh-uh, not in our backyard, and managed to keep Boston University from getting a piece of the pie. I'm sure that was not good. That's where I did my training, was Boston City Hospital. I'm sure they weren't happy about that. Now, I just want to go in the third part of this on civil liberties. And there's a New England Journal article, and this is very nice. It was written in 2002, which was a kind of a tough time to write this kind of article. You may, even if we weren't having witch hunts exactly, by George Innes. And he said, in concluding, laws that provide funding for training and recognition and treatment of diseases caused by pathogens, et cetera, and also laws that work on communication, coordination, and response are important. The Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention deserves our support, and that's actually in contra to what the government was doing at the time. In my opinion, laws that treat Americans and their physicians as the enemy and grant broad arbitrary powers to public health officials without making them accountable do not deserve support and distract us from important work that needs to be done. It's a very important thing. And then this is from a blog site of, I think, kind of one of those right-wing places that doesn't like for you to vaccinate their children. But they did put in here some interesting things that it's important for us to remember. You know, when you're saying a public health emergency, what you're telling the state militia to do is take control of all roads, seize your house, car, telephones, computers, food, fuel, clothing, firearms, alcoholic beverages for their own use. That's going a little far maybe, but I don't know what they do with that stuff they take, you know, as you're going into the airport, and not be liable. And then arrest, imprison, and forcibly examine, vaccinate, and medicate you and your children without your consent and not be liable. But this is absolutely true. So can anyone, kind of in closing here and in tribute to someone for whom I have so much respect, Steve, can anybody tell us, does anybody know this name? This room? No. Okay. I know that you have ways of getting movies. So there's a movie called Strange Culture. And let me explain to you. The movie Strange Culture, you're asleep, right? And you wake up. You're an artist, a professor at the University of Buffalo. And you wake up and your wife is dead. Been married many, many years. She was an artist as well. You work together with children, trying to stimulate people's minds. Your wife is dead. What do you do? I don't know. What he did was call 911. People came. They saw that his wife was dead. She was dead. Took him to the hospital. But those 911 people were very astute. They knew a bioterror lab when they saw one. And they saw that in the corner of his house was something that looked like a laboratory. And that laboratory had spores of some kind in it. So they called in the FBI. And when Steve Kutz comes back from where his wife has been declared dead, she had a heart attack, he can't get into his house. It's totally blocked off. He's put under arrest. He's grilled for hours and hours. And what happens is he's a member of a group that uses art to look at social justice issues, including the government. And he's a pretty famous group. He's and he had gotten one of his friends, a genetics professor from the University of Pittsburgh, chair of the department, to get some mail order spores of some kind. And he had included those within an exhibit that he was going to put forth in an art exhibit. And this is the kind of thing he did all the time. And that was what was there. But because the FBI needed a scapegoat so badly, they actually imprisoned him and then released him. But he was under arrest from 2004, this is when this happened, until in April of this year, when a judge finally, hearing everything, said, there is no, you couldn't even have done this. There's no way, just looking at it, it's not the case. But in that meantime, the person who had given him the spores was said to have done mail fraud, and he had a terminal disease, so he just paid $500 and said, no contest, he passed on. And Steve Kutz, I mean, you know, he said, I didn't have time to mourn my wife. They were saying, what about mourning your wife? He said, you know, when you're in a, let's say you're in a jungle, and your partner gets eaten by a lion, there's a lot of hungry lions around, you're not going to mourn them right then. You're probably going to try to do what you can to get out. And that's the way he described his life for those 4 years. And I wrote him an email. I just told him I was doing this. And this is what he said. Hi, Lanny. Tell them to worry about events worth worrying about. Bioterrorism should be on the bottom of the list of topics for consideration by any public health association. Rather than allocating time, even conference time and resources to prepare for an unlikely event, while there are so many health crises killing tens of thousands of people, he could have put millions, a public health association should keep their agenda focused on the here and now, and probably crises, not just a modest, albeit scary event that might happen. Good luck with the talk, Steve. So I'll close with that. Thank you.
Thank you. In addition to the official time, I don't think there's any other session here for a while, so we'll stay as long as people are willing to stay for questions, comments, whatever you'd like to do. So would anybody like to either ask a question, make a comment on any of the talks? Yes, please.
So I'd like to answer that, and I don't think that's what happened. I think that the people in the current administration are very astute politically, and they knew a moment that they could capitalize upon when they saw it. They basically put all of the agendas they had prepared. It made them able to implement them without people being able to do anything because they were using the fear factor. I will say that there have been official plans by the government to do something like this. There's something called the Northwoods experiment. You know what that is? And you can go, it's the Freedom of Information Act. And if you don't know about it, Northwoods, there were several scenarios that they were planning on doing around Cuba to sinking a U.S. ship and other things like that. I think that had already been tried in Vietnam, but never mind. And and this was official plans or blowing up other things in order to have a pretext to invade Cuba, and they wound up not doing that. But this is official part of the military record. You can go look at it now at northwoods.information. If you Google it, it'll come up. I personally don't think that they did that, and I don't think that it was somebody who worked at one of these labs that felt like they needed more funding that sent out the letters, although it would be quite a useful thing for them if they had, because tons of money came. But I don't think that. But I do think that people then jumped on what they saw is a wonderful opportunity to get money for their lab and to implement their increasingly fascistic anti-civil liberties policies.
Yes?
I'd like to ask an unrelated question. I'm from Western Massachusetts, where Lyme disease is a problem, and underground sense that somehow Lyme disease was a result of a release from biological weapons lab in Long Island. Is there any evidence or any background on that at all, or is that just a urban myth, or actually in this case a rural myth?
Well, I have no evidence, or no. Actually, this is the first I've heard of that. One of the blowbacks, if you will, of allowing public health organizations and establishment health societies and so on being involved in things like the smallpox campaign, being involved in going along with the bioterrorism program, it undermines our credibility as public health professionals. And whether or not something like this is true, in the same way that the Tuskegee horror show undermined the trust of the American public with researchers, these types of activities, when a scare story is put out and then it turns out to be bogus again and again, it undermines the credibility. So whether or not, and it breeds that type of suspicion and skepticism. And who knows? Maybe it's so, maybe not. There were releases. People may remember the sheep that died from the accidental release of nerve gas in, I think, Arizona, Nevada, I forget, in the 70s. So is it impossible? No. Is it likely? Don't know. But the problem is our integrity as public health workers is one of our greatest assets. And the trust of the public, without the trust of the public, public health professionals, the health workers cannot do their job. And this type of program undermines that.
In terms of your question, I would agree that there's no evidence of that being the case, but it did make me think about yet another thing for us to consider in terms of what our capability should be. Lyme disease is one of the agents that is expected from the various international panels on climate change to be rising, emerging and re-emerging infectious diseases, along with a whole other host of organisms. We can think of West Nile virus, for example, in terms of diseases that have heretofore been tropical diseases now taking root in what might become tropical climates that hadn't been before. So to the degree that we have, again, focused on these types of programs to the neglect of preparing for the likely spread due to new vectors and new agents, these are concerns we need to be thinking about in an era of unfolding climate change.
Yes, sir.
One of the things I hadn't heard from the panelists, and it's really kind of below the radar screen, is the NVAP, the proposed National Bio and Agro Defense Facility. This would be a phase out of the current ESL-3 facility at Plum Island, and a movement to the mainland under Department of Homeland Security, and a construction of an over 500,000 square foot facility, over 50,000 square feet of which would be ESL-4 space. CDC, on its entire campus, only has about half that amount. I was just curious as to, you know, what, if any of you have been following that at all, or anything of that, because, as I said, Plum is pretty much focused on, swine fever, vesicular stomatitis, and FMD. And they've only said that they will look at NEPA and Hendra as zoonotics in this BL4 space on the mainland, but as you all know, that's not a whole hell of a lot to consume 50,000 square feet of space.
Yeah, Thank you for bringing that to my attention. I'd seen it, but I was not fully aware of the scope of it. And the way you describe it, it's awfully scary, because what are they doing with all that space?
Well, and it's a concern on many ends. It's a concern on the end of industry. It's a concern on the end of USDA. Is this, as you phase out this this facility and its staff who dedicated their career to these diseases, you know, will that ethos, will that culture be lost in a new location? And will there be a pivot towards something else?
Well, it's certainly a major concern. It, also, just the existence of Plum Island as a special agent place so close to New York City was also a concern. There was a period before the, you know, when they were trying to relocate it, there was a strike by government workers at Plum Island. Where, I'm not sure if they were the direct workers or they were maintenance facilities, but there was some union organized workers who went on strike, and they brought in scabs, and there was a real issue of whether or not the safety features were being compromised. But
as someone who spent a significant amount of time at Plum, I would say for the disease portfolio they're working on right now, it's probably no safer place in the country to have it.
Okay.
You have you know, less than 200 ruminants on all of Long Island, and this buffer zone is New York City, New Jersey, before any of that spread could happen to the cattle country. I don't know. I think that's probably
okay, I'll accept that, but I think what's going on now is there quite a number of locales are trying to get the facility because they want the money, and at the same time, local residents in the areas that have been cited as potential places have been organizing opposition to it in the same way that Tri-Valley Cares is trying to organize opposition to that siting. I would suggest that these types of facilities are inherently safe. Are they necessary? A couple of them are. I mean, research should be done. But the extent of them and the proliferation of them and the scope of them has to be balanced within the need. And if the need or the danger of the, especially the bioweapons agents and the bioterrorism stuff, as you know, we're trying to present here, is that the, you know, when you weigh risks and benefits, the benefit of these facilities is based on the risk. If the risk is minimal, then, you know, of an event, then all these facilities that have their own adverse events, that their own risks from doing them, you know, side effects, or if you will, in the same way that the anthrax release was a side effect of the lab that was studying these spores. And those, I would suggest that in that balance, there is so, the risk of a bioterrorist event is so small in the absence of the materials. It's not that terrorism, that there aren't terrorists out there who would like to do harm. That's a given. But why in all these years has there not been a bioterrorist event except for the exception that proved the rule? The missing ingredient is the material, because dynamite you can get. Fertilizer fuel, you can get. Airline fuel, you can get. But these weaponized biological pathogens are extremely difficult to get. And even those who have tried have failed. So if we proliferate the facilities that deal in this stuff, we're adding to the danger. But thank you very much for bringing that out.
Just want to, I think that's a really good question, and I think a lot of our concerns about the Tri-Valley Cares and we had in terms of siting the Tracy facility was to cite those types of operations in terms of animal testing facilities. I would, you know, say the following. I think my personal view is that research like this is needed, and, you know, I mean, diseases such as hoof and mouth disease, and you can go down the list of potential animal disease, it could be extremely devastating. I think for me, the critical issue is transparency. And it gets back to how you're gonna develop the sort of global confidence in a strong biological weapons convention where you actually do have the ability to, because it's easy to hide operations. And how do you develop the mutual confidence to be able to have challenge and adequate verification types of protocols that you can make sure that any country who's might be doing or could plausibly be doing legitimate vaccine research, that one can make sure with that type of confidence that it's not going to be diverted towards offensive agents. I mean, this is going to be, I think, an issue that's going to dog us as technology improves. I mean, and I think for something like this, that's the only way out. And I would just would hope that a new administration would go back and you know, join or you know, continue the efforts that were really abrogated in 2001 to be able to join with other countries and figure out a way to do that.
Any other questions, comments, follow-up, anything? Anyone?